The death of a civil rights icon remembered today on UK Perspectives. I'm Tom Goodell. 50 years ago, Medgar Evers was gunned down in Mississippi in his own driveway. Earlier this year, UK poet Frank X. Walker published his latest book, Turn Me Loose, The Unghosting of Medgar Evers, which has since been transformed into a one-hour radio program by our guest, DeBron Thomas. Welcome to UK Perspectives, DeBron.
Thank you, Tom.
What was it that got you interested in this project?
Well, first of all, I have always been interested in everything regarding the civil rights movement. And when I heard about this story, I think one of the biggest things was that there was no push for it to be aired in February, that it didn't want to be lumped in with all the extra stuff in February for, you know, Black History Month. And at the same time, I also feel that for my generation, you know, I'm 24 years old and, you know, very far removed from 1963. But at the same time, the lasting impacts of the civil rights movement impact me every day and my particular lifestyle. You know, not a day goes by where something doesn't come up. And I work with kids as well. And another issue that comes up is there's this, well, at least with that generation that I see, is there's a complete distance from the civil rights movement to now. And it's like, it doesn't, all that was, oh, well, that was ancient. But it really wasn't that long ago.
For those who may not be familiar with his legacy, who was Medgar Evers and why is his life and his death still important to us today?
Well, for all intents and purposes, Medgar Evers was pretty much one of the most American people that you could be under the, you know, kind of blanket term of what an American is. And, you know, he was an Air Force veteran. Well, I guess he was at Normandy, and you know, he was a member of both the SCLC and SNCC. And he actually, one of the things that I found interesting about this whole situation was that he actually decided to leave, I think it was SNCC, because he didn't want to be involved with two different movements at the same time, and ended up writing a letter to Martin Luther King. But, you know, Martin Luther King is the basic name that you hear about the civil rights movement. And Medgar Evers was doing stuff 4 years before Martin Luther King even marched in Montgomery. You know, he was doing this stuff a long time ago. And not to take anything away from Dr. King, but Medgar Evers had been started doing the grassroots kind of campaign, going door to door and getting people that way.
And he died before Martin Luther King, so his voice was silenced far earlier in the movement.
Right, and he was assassinated by Byron Dale Beckwith in 1963 from a gunshot to the back in his own driveway. The thing about this particular program is that Frank's book uses poems that take on the personification of different people within his life, including Merle Evers, his widow, Charles Evers, his brother, Byron Dale Beckwith, his assassin, and both of Byron Dale Beckwith's wives. Now, there are also a few different poems that are historical narratives, but one in particular comes from the viewpoint of the bullet. This is an excerpt from a poem called One-Third of 180 Grams of Lead.
What was cruel was the irony, not the melon, not the man falling in slow motion, but the man squinting through the crosshairs, reducing the justice system to a small circle, praying that he not miss, then sending me to deliver a message, as if the woman screaming in the dark or the children crying at her feet could ever believe a bullet was small enough to hate.
Powerful stuff there.
How did you go about taking this book, which uses all of these persona poems, and turning it into a radio program?
Well, that was the challenge at the beginning. We decided to not go with your typical narrative format, basically having somebody kind of hold your hand along the way. We wanted you to experience it the way that it would have been experienced in 1963. Basically, you're just kind of thrown into it, and this is the way it was. And Frank holds no punches. He is very, very accurate with most of the stuff that he wrote. And a lot of it is very tear-jerking. So in turning this into a radio program, it was really laborious just on the fact that listening to these poems, listening to these songs, and listening to these stories, you know, from my particular perspective, it's really hard to imagine that this is the way life was back then. And it's not that it's unbelievable, because you learn about this in school, but when you're a kid, you get the Disney version of it. You don't get, you know, like you hear about Rosa Parks, but you don't hear about Claudette Colvin, who did the same thing 6 months earlier, you know. So making this a radio program was difficult in the fact that you kind of had to not think of things from the typical, well, it's going to have this structure, this structure, this structure. We based everything around the poems and kind of let everything else lay it as it was. So when John, the operations manager here, when we decided to take down the list of poems, we decided which poems would fit based on kind of which particular section of the show. It's listed, broken up into three parts. Part A is more about the death of Medgar Evers. It focuses on, you know, kind of what it was like to be in 1963 at that point. And that's what some of the poems there are about. Part B focuses on the trial of Byron De La Beckwith.
Wasn't it? Were there three?
Yeah, there were three. There was, he was finally put in jail in 1994. But so part B is about the trials and everything that went along with that. And you'll hear a lot more from the voices of Willie De La Beckwith and Mary Louise De La Beckwith. And
these were the assassin's two wives.
Yeah,
not simultaneously, yeah. but De La Beckwith had two wives, and those are the voices that you hear.
Right. And that would be, Willie De La Beckwith and Thelma De La Beckwith. Mary Louise is Willie. So you basically get a kind of a touch into what it was like from that perspective. And that's one of the things that makes this whole thing unique is Frank X. Walker is an African American, but all the poems are written from the perspectives of people who are not just African American. And some of these viewpoints are dug deep. And I think that's one of the most amazing things about the show is that Frank was able to cultivate both sides of the argument, whether he believed in one side or the other. And that's what made it so special. And then part C is focusing on the past, the present, and the future. Where do we go from here? And it's also very significant to note that Merle Evers Williams gave
It was a speech at the inauguration, the second inauguration of Barack Obama.
And, you know, it's important to notice that, you know, 50 years ago, people were fighting for these rights, and now we have an African-American president. And so that's kind of how the show got formed. And, you know, really when it comes to a lot of other things, there were some things that just kind of fell in our laps as far as, you know, the song A Pawn in Their Game by Bob Dylan. It was written about Medgar Evers, and he actually performed it at the March on Washington in 1963. And, you know, another thing that I found was the audio from Medgar Evers' actual funeral. There's things like that where a lot of it was planned, and, you know, we had an idea of where we were going to go with it, but for the most part, it just kind of came together naturally.
And you mentioned Frank's ability to get inside the heads of the people on both sides, the assassin and the family that was affected by the killing of Medgar Evers. We have an example, don't we?
Actually, there is the poem that's from the voice of Thelma De La Beckwith. This is called Big Hearted, and this is her speaking to Merle Evers, basically saying, you know, you're lucky that he was killed this way.
Your shallow faith won't let you see his generosity or his compassion. Don't you see the courtesy he extended to you by opening up a hole in that boy's black back and not his face?
And I find it significant that he says, that boy is back.
Yeah, that's the ability, the genius of Frank X. Walker. And that's the reason why he is the poet laureate of the state of Kentucky. I mean, I've had so much fun working with him. You know, I hate saying fun after hearing something like that, but it's been really great for me because I, as an African American, it's always been hard for me to understand why somebody would do this to somebody else, why, you know, someone would oppress someone else. But in a perfect world, if you have power, you use it. And that's kind of one of the things that I think that Frank kind of used when he wrote these poems, coming from, you know, the Southern aspect.
You spoke with several other people besides Frank Walker during the making of this program, and among them was Everett McCorvey, who teaches opera here at the University of Kentucky, but also in his early years had some pretty vivid recollections of the civil rights movement.
Yeah, Everett McCorvey actually grew up in Montgomery, Alabama, and he lived right around the corner from Dr. King, actually, and his father is a deacon at the same church that Ralph Abernathy used to preach at. And so that living in Montgomery at that time, there was a lot going on, especially with George Wallace, who was the governor of Alabama.
And known for his statement, segregation now, segregation forever.
Right. And during this process, I guess the whole process of making this show, Everett told me a story that still kind of resonates with me very, very deeply from when he was 6 years old.
We were out at recess one day, and there was a church across the street, and having a Southern Christian Leadership Conference meeting, and George Wallace was the governor, sent state troopers and policemen on horseback to the church, and we saw these horses coming down the street, and then all of a sudden, the horses were going up the steps and into the church. And they beat everybody into the church, out of the church.
And when I hear that, it's not only chilling, but it makes me think not of 1960s, but of a completely different era, a century earlier.
Mm-hmm. And that was actually a sanctioned action by the governor. It was that the governor said, this can happen. And you know, that's one of, I think hearing that story is another reason why I'm so passionate about this project, because for me, you know, you think about the Emmett Tills and the Trayvon Martins and the Oscar Grants. You know, Oscar Grant was a 22-year-old resident of the San Francisco Bay Area who was killed by a BART officer. And that's one of those things where you bring up, you know, George Zimmerman, and you bring up all these things that happened, like Johannes Messerli, who was the officer who shot Oscar Grant. And the way I think about it is it's not necessarily a racism factor. It's fear caused by racism. And that this fear that has been perpetuated causes people to do things that a lot of other people say, well, that's a little irrational, don't you think? But the fact that people still do it is a point that needs to be made. You know, would George Zimmerman have followed Trayvon Martin if he wasn't afraid, if he wasn't driven by this fear? And I think one of the most interesting things I've learned about doing this project, like I mentioned earlier, I worked with kids, and there was this one girl who decided to continuously use the N-word. She's African American. And I told her several times, she's 14 years old. I told her several times, I said, look, you know, don't use that kind of language. You know, don't use that word. You don't need to be using it here nor anywhere else. And she kept fighting me on it. And she said, oh, well, you're the only one here that finds it offensive. And I pointed to a coworker of mine who's one of my very, very close friends who's white. And I said, it offends him. And she decided to kind of keep fighting me on it. And there was about 11 or 12 year old boy that walked up who's white. And I later learned that his foster mother is black. But he walked up and this girl was, you know, making a scene and using the N-word gratuitously. And he came up and just started laughing. And it wasn't the, ha-ha laugh. It was the, if you've ever been discriminated against and somebody else walks up and laughs at you, it was that laugh. And then this guy's sister came up, and the girl who was continuously using the N-word asked this little girl, well, you wouldn't feel, you know, you wouldn't be offended if I called somebody that, you know the N-word. And she said, yeah, I would. And so I got this packet that I gave to this girl. It was an article that came out in 1955 in Look magazine. And it detailed the entire event of Emmett Till from the point of view of the two men who abducted him. And as I was reading this, I gave this to her, you know, and I put a picture of Emmett Till with his mother on the cover. And I said, just read this. Yeah, you don't have to, you know, I don't want to hear anything from you about it. Like, you don't have to write anything. Just read it and tell me what you think. And, you know, I'm hoping that it has kind of a lasting impact on her. But when I was reading the article, one of the things that struck out most to me was, you know, the quotes that the men were giving to Emmett Till. They drove him around, you know, and when they got to his house, they asked him, hey, well, you need to come with us. And he's like, well, you know, I was like, all right, let me get dressed. I said, no, just put your shoes on. And Emmett Till at 14 said, man, I don't wear shoes without socks. And that this kid was not afraid. He was not afraid and didn't think that they were going to do anything to him. Granted, he was from Chicago and went to Mississippi, but he was not afraid at any point, even when they had him in the back seat of the car. You know, he was just kind of whistling and pretending like nothing was going on. And one of the quotes that struck out the most in the article was right before they killed him. One of the assailants said, you know, they basically told him to strip naked, and they tied him up with barbed wire. And they asked him, you still think you're as good as us? And Emmett Till said, yeah. And they said, you still been with white women? And Emmett Till said, yes. And that's when they shot him. And they beat him, shot him, threw his body in a river, and he was found by two kids fishing 3 days later. And I knew about this, but I didn't know. There was nothing that ever took me there. And for him to not be afraid at 14 changes my perspective on a lot of different things. And hearing Everett at 6 witnessing this, and that the fact that it still resonates with him today in 2013, it is something that this story needs to be told for all the people whose stories haven't been told.
You mentioned the N-word, and that plays a role in this broadcast as well. And I would think that young lady you were talking about should read those two poems that go back-to-back on the show, and they're also back-to-back in the book, where you have the assassin's perspective on the N-word and essentially saying how much fun it is to use it and how much fun it is to abuse black people. And then you have Medgar Evers' brother saying what the N-word means to him. It's one of the most powerful moments in the show and in the book.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because, you know, I think that the way that the N-word has become now has kind of, it's always been a form of camaraderie amongst African Americans, because when I was doing this show, I was kind of talking to my dad about it. My dad was born in 1952, and I was just kind of asking him about different things, and he said, "Well, the thing about the N-word, because before this, I thought that, you know, a long time ago, I like to blame the N-word on." You know, kind of the hip hop culture, but that's not the case. And I saw this documentary on this concert, Watt Stax, that was the Stax Volt, basically kind of, so it was billed as the black version of Woodstock, and it was held in LA. in 1973, and the whole thing was narrated by Richard Pryor. And Richard Pryor went into like different barbershops and was talking to these guys, and they were using the N-word.
And Richard Pryor is a prominent user of the word as well.
Right. Well, and he also said at one point that, you know, that the word offended him and that he wasn't going to use it anymore. But I was talking to my dad about this because I had seen this documentary many years ago, and I was, you know, reading these poems. And my dad said, well, the thing was, is you know, we called each other nigger. You know, it was a brotherly thing, but you never used it in front of white people. And one of the most interesting things that happened to me when I was in high school was there was a guy that I had been going to school with for years, and he was Hispanic. And he came up to me one day and was like, what's up, my nigga? I said, hey, what's up, my wetback? And he looked at me and said, hey, man, that's not cool. I said, oh, really? Because you just called me a racial slur, so I threw one right back at you, and now you're offended?
Mm-hmm.
And he tried to tell me, oh, it's different. I don't think so.
Yeah. Music is also very important in this show. You mentioned Bob Dylan's A Pawn in Their Game, but there are other songs from 1963, and there are other again, like the two perspectives on the N-word, there are two perspectives on some other songs in this show as well. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, I, as a musician, music is something I'm very, very passionate about. And I, you know, when we started kind of putting together the show, we knew that it was going to have the poetry and the music. But the music, in a sense, was going to take place of that narrative that kind of guides you through it. And music is a universal language. It has no color. You know, the only colors that, you know, as Jimi Hendrix once said, the only colors I see are in music, you know, and that's kind of how I view things. And the thing with this show is that the music of 1963 was where we wanted to stay. There's one outlier. There's one song that is outlier, which is Stand By Your Man, which was released in 1968. But that's only because there's a poem that references the song. Every piece of music in the show was recorded in 1960, was either recorded in or before 1963. It also features A Change Is Gonna Come, which was recorded in 1963, but released in 1964. And my little bit of OCD was just like, well, I'll just let this one go. But one of the best moments in the show, I think, was there's a poem called Music, Niggers, and Jews. And it's by Byron De La Beckwith. And he's talking about, you know, all these long-haired hippies and all these people coming in. And he mentions Johnny Cash. And when Johnny Cash played on, you know, what was the show that Dick Clark had?
American Bandstand.
Yeah, when he went on American Bandstand, he said he lit the stage on fire. And so that poem, and the poem ends saying, and Dick Clark is no better than a nigger to me. And then that is followed by Johnny Cash's version of Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. And one of the interesting things in the editing process was that was followed by an American spiritual version of Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. And right as Johnny Cash's version fades out, the American Spiritual Ensemble, which is Everett McCorvey's group, fades in with the same words. And, you know, the Negro spiritual is a Negro spiritual. And it's a religious song. It doesn't matter who's singing it. So for me, that was kind of the ultimate, like, well, yes, okay, but there's also this, you know.
Two different perspectives on the song and two completely different feels to
well,
the song.
Everything with the music, you know, this is one thing I'd like to be that to let it be known that every single piece of music in the show has a purpose, whether it's a chord progression, whether it's something that someone says, every single piece of music has a reason to be where it is at that particular time. And like, for instance, there's this song that comes after this poem called Haiku for Emmett Till. And it's a song called Evil by Howlin' Wolf. And it says, you know, you're a long way from home, can't sleep at night. You know, another mule's kicking in your stall, that's evil. And to me, you have somebody singing the blues from Chicago, you know, after that. And it's just powerful how much music can touch you regardless of when it was recorded. So there was a lot of crate digging that had to be done for this show, but every single song has a purpose. It, you know, whether it's, you know, for whatever reason it is, it's there. It's there for a reason. And that's one thing that I can at least say that I'm really proud of the show, is that the music is just as important as the poems were. And that's what I was trying to convey as well.
Yeah, it provides context, and it also expands on some of the themes that you hear in the poems. It enhances the experience tremendously for me.
And let's not leave out the historical context that was given to us by Everett McCorvey and Dr. Gerald Smith, Dr. Gerald Smith is an associate professor of history here at the University of Kentucky. And he was the one that actually told me about Medgar Evers and Dr. Martin Luther King sharing letters back and forth to each other. Basically, you know, when Medgar Evers was resigning from one of the civil rights groups. And he also kind of gave a real big, you know, kind of hand in adding the kind of academic portion, because Everett brought a emotional perspective and Dr. Gerald Smith brought, you know, yes, it was emotional, but it was factual. Not saying that Everett's not factual, but his, you know, growing up in Alabama, that's where he was coming from. And Dr. Gerald Smith was coming from a point of, well, I lived through this as well, and this is what happened.
I think, too, one of the many things that impressed me about Medgar Evers, the man, was that he was not afraid to die. He said, young men are dying in Vietnam right now, and I am not afraid to die in this cause because it is so important. How did that strike you as you read about that aspect of Evers' life?
Well, it goes back to the, you know, the kind of the Emmett Till thing of not being afraid. And that's one thing I try to explain to other people when talking about issues of race in this country, at least, is that so many people gave their lives so that we could live the way that we do. You know, so many people gave their lives so that I could sleep in on a Saturday morning. People gave their lives so that I could be a graduate of the University of Kentucky. People gave their lives so that I could get on a plane, you know.
Or use a bathroom.
use a water fountain, you know, anything. Go into, you know, play in a music club. Go into a bar, play in a bar, you know. It is one thing that needs to be remembered is that all these people did all this and were willing to sacrifice everything. Dr. King sacrificed his life. You know, I mean, even in the Black Panther movement, you know, Huey Newton went to jail. Fred Hampton was assassinated by the government. You know, he gave his life, and Fred Hampton was trying to, it was a little bit different side of the movement, but he was trying to bring everybody together, you know, blacks, whites, the Hispanic population, you know, the gays, the lesbians, the women, you know, all these different movements. He was trying to bring them together, and he was killed at the age of 21.
It was the original Rainbow Coalition.
The original Rainbow Coalition, which was later kind of taken over by Jesse Jackson. But you know, and the thing is with every single name that you hear, there's a bunch of other names that you don't hear. There are people that, I mean, I took a African-American studies class, and I knew a lot about the atrocities that had happened to people of color. But seeing pictures of lynchings with a bunch of people smiling like they're at a picnic, there was so much anger that came up inside of me. But at the same time, it's a sign of the times. And those people aren't necessarily bad for sitting there smiling. They're not bad people. They were just part of the time. And I think that's one thing that needs to be separated between 1963 and 2013 is, yes, there are people who are still like that, but you look at how we are now, the majority of people aren't like that. The majority of people don't think like that. At least I would hope so. And at the same time, you can't fault one group of people for the actions of a few people. You know, I mean, it goes both ways. You know, I don't blame every single person who is not of color for the atrocities that happened during slavery. And I would hope that, you know, if hypothetically speaking, if someone's brother was killed by a person of color, that this person wouldn't try to lash out at me. And the same goes for, I don't mean to get this deep, but the same goes for people who are of the Islamic faith. Just because a few people decide to blow up a building, everybody who's a part of that faith isn't that person.
And that sentiment is expressed in the book as well, when Merle Evers toward the end talks about how she sees things in the eyes of white people today that tell her that things have changed and that attitudes have changed. And it's a very powerful moment in the book also.
Yeah, there's a clip from a poem called Gift of Time in which she kind of talks about that.
When I was able to see beauty in a world littered with scars, when I discovered stores of memories that a bullet couldn't quit, when I watched a son grow into his father's face, his laugh, his walk, I saw how faith could be restored.
And, you know, listening to that and kind of hearing that understanding, even though there's all this, you know, all this evil that has happened, you still have clarity. And I think that's one of the most important things of this book is that it needs to spark, the purpose of the book and the show itself is to spark a conversation that continues to kind of be put under the rug a little bit. And, you know, and that's another thing to Frank is that when he reads the poems, you can hear how his voice changes depending on who he's reading. I've been working on this project for months, so I know, but hopefully, you know, once people listen to it, then get into it long enough, you know, get into the show long enough, they'll also hear it too. I mean, it's a performance, but it's a performance that has so much meaning. And it just goes to show that, you know, people say sticks and stones can break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Well, words are just as powerful.
Thank you. Our guest has been DeBron Thomas, producer of The Unghosting of Medgar Evers, which airs this Saturday at 2 p.m. and again on Labor Day at 7 p.m. There's also more information about the show and a history of the civil rights movement at WUKY.org, where you can also find this complete UK Perspectives interview. For WUKY, I'm Tom Goodell.